this week on Retronauts. Hey everybody, it's me, Bob Mackey, your host for episode 11 of Retronauts, and today's topic is the history of video game voice acting. I've introduced myself, let's introduce everyone else. Who is across the table from me right there?
Ray Varnholt.
And who are you, Ray?
I'm a guy who's also on Retronauts.
Cool.
Contrary to popular belief.
So am I, we have so much in common. Who else do we have?
I like long walks on the beach, sorry.
I am Chris Doucette, and I am a random guy who walked in off the street.
How did you get in here, Chris? What gives you the right to record with us, in other words?
Cold hard cash.
That's right. Yeah. If you pay us enough money, we'll be your friend. But Chris is here, and he suggested the topic for today. But we have one special other guest here remotely. Who is Skyping in with us?
Oh man, am I relegated to special guest status now? Really?
You're like in the sitcom credits, like, and featuring podcast. Jeremy Parrish. But wow. please let us know who you are, Jeremy.
My heart's a little broken. I am Jeremy Parrish. That's right. You just mentioned that.
Jeremy moved.
That's me.
He moved far away. I don't know why. I took it personally, actually, but apparently
did
it
was, you?
Yes,
it was
I did.
To get further away from you.
God,
Bob,
I knew
I still
it.
Follow you on Twitter, so it's not working out so
I thought
well.
So. See?
This is one of our hidden stretch goals, actually.
Real kidding, Jeremy.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say before we start that this is our first podcast with Jeremy remotely, and we are figuring out the best way to do this, and this is the best way we're doing it now. It's going to improve over time, so please just have some patience with us.
Yes.
And I'm also, this is going to be the first episode where I'm going to be playing clips live. Ray has done it before. He does it on his other podcast.
Yes.
And I wanted to kind of experiment with this to save me some time with editing and sort of have a more spontaneous, fun recording session. And there's a lot of fun things to talk about today because today's topic, let's get to it, guys. It's the history of voice acting. So let's ask Chris, why did you choose this topic? I'm just interested in knowing. Like, what is it about voice acting in general that you're so interested in?
Well, so cartoons were a big part of my growing up, as probably you guys as well, as much as video games were. We grew up in a sort of a golden age for TV cartoons between The Simpsons and Disney and Warner Brothers. And now, as an adult, and now that IMDb exists, going back and finding out that all these people are now also recording voices in video games is super interesting, and I've been sucked into that hole of like, oh, this person was in this thing. Who else was in this thing? Oh, that person? Oh, and what they were? For hours at a time.
Yeah.
And we're going to be talking about a lot of those actors today. So I basically would just want to get started here with a sort of a preface to this. This is just my take on things. You guys are free to disagree, and I do want to hear what you think about it. So sort of like along with the pixely, blocky graphics, I feel like repetitive and robotic voice samples are sort of like make up the texture of what a video game is, at least in popular opinion. Like if you see parodies of video games, even today, one of the things they'll make fun of is like, you know, repetitive voice samples or repetitive voice clips, like to the right. point of hilarity. But really, I just wanted to talk about the scope of this episode. It's only going to go up until the late 90s because, voice acting has been in video games since kind of the very beginning. And I wanted to find a good jumping off point. And we're just going to kind of cover a lot of the highlights and the lowlights. There's no way to, sort of cover all of this in just one episode. But really, I just want to know before we get started, like, what does voice acting in video games, like, what do you immediately think of Ray, Jeremy, and Chris, when you think of voice acting in games? I'll start with Jeremy because he is far away. We need to include him.
Gordon
in this.
Freeman.
Yes.
That's what I think of. I think of sort of silly, over-enunciated, overacted attempts at adding character to video games. And, you know, that's not always the case. But generally speaking, it's that sort of Resident Evil, Half-Life era of voice quality, of acting quality or lack of quality that kind of sticks in my mind as video game voice acting.
When every scientist had the same voice, basically.
Yeah. Oh, they're all the same voice, even if they're black or white, or it doesn't matter. Yeah, these days, video game voice acting is basically a fisticuffs between Nolan North and Troy Baker.
What about Steve Bloom? Is he part of this?
He's there, but he usually plays more of the secondary characters. It's Nolan North and Troy Baker that show up in every game, and it's one or the other of them as the lead.
Right.
It's true. So, Chris, what do you immediately think of, what's most evocative to you when it comes to video game voice acting? Like, when you hear that phrase, like, what is the first thing you think of?
I think a lot about RPGs, particularly the PS1 Dreamcast era.
Ooh, okay.
RPGs that I played a lot. And thinking about how I kind of don't want to go back and play them because of the voice acting.
any titles in particular? I mean, I'm sure I could, as soon as you say them, like the voices are going to pop into my brain, you know, immediately.
Check this out.
Yeah, I think the one that sort of hurts me the most is Grandia 2, because I would really like to go back and play that game, but I just cringe to like reimagine what that must have sounded like in 2000.
Yeah, I guess so. I
mean, was it definitely a little bit later than that? But yeah, I think a lot of localized games took a long time to get up to like what we would consider to be acceptable voice acting.
Definitely, it was more like find some family members that don't mind being credited under pseudonyms.
Exactly.
Ray, how about you?
Well, you know, I used to, when I first experienced voice acting in games, it was kind of scary. Because I was also a little kid, and I was kind of easily impressionable that way, and so like things that were starting to be like TV were kind of scaring me. Like, you know, the first time I heard a voice in the game, I was like, what? It's supposed to be like TV now? Oh god. And in fact, I really was more genuinely scared when I first heard it in like Altered Beast and stuff, and that just, you know.
So in your mind, a video game was not supposed to talk, and it was violating some law of nature.
Yes, exactly. And that definitely, you know, dates me, and I'm sure everyone else here. It's like, you know, to those younger listeners out there, it's like it's such a normal thing now, but it used to not be.
Definitely. So
I never actually thought the, voice acting per se was scary. It was the stuff that came before that. The voice synthesis. I don't know if that's really within the scope of this episode.
Oh, it definitely is.
But, you know, like speech synthesizers on like the TI-99/4A computer or the Intellivision or, you know, in arcades, that sort of synthetic robot sound, that stuff was like genuinely scary. And they usually used it to that effect, you know, something like Berserk or Sinistar.
Right. And to go over sort of basically the early years of voice acting, it was really like voice acting was a way to draw people towards your game. It was sort of like the Carnival Barker, but right, in digital format, because if you were walking through an arcade and one of the games was talking to you, often taunting you, often like, I don't know, at least trying to seem intimidating, you know, you would be like, yeah, well, I'll show you, game, because you're a small child and you're like, this thing shouldn't be talking to me. Maybe you were Ray at the time.
Right.
Who knows? But I dug up some history, and the first voice acting in a video game was 1980s Stratovox, aka Speak and Rescue. The game is essentially named after its main gimmick, and I'm going to play a clip for you guys. This extremely unintelligible voice sample. Maybe you can tell me what is being said here, because I only knew once I looked it up. So here is Stratovox in 1 second. It's coming. Okay, that's enough of that. So what do you think was being said there? I mean,
I heard "hug me" and "spoil sport."
Chris, what did you hear?
All I could think of was the guy in Spaceballs who's talking into the radio.
Oh god! Yeah, it does sound like an old stand-up bit about the McDonald's drive-thru or something like that. Jeremy, were you able to make out anything of that?
Cheeseburger, Pepsi fries.
Okay.
Actually, it sounded kind of obscene. It sounded like he said "great tit" or something.
Whoa,
like that. That's really. I'm really offended by this video game.
So really,
to be completely honest,
the ambiguity of what it was saying drew in all sorts of audiences, didn't it? But it was actually saying "thank you" and "very good."
So where was this made?
Japan. It was made by Taito, and it's called Speak and Rescue. But Jeremy brought up another game, Berserk, and I'll play a clip from that. And this could be. I assume this scared me as well as a child. So let's hear what Berserk sounds like. So that was Berserk. And I assume that these are not actually like recorded voices. These are ways to figure out how to make electronics, you know, vibrate in ways that would sound like a voice.
They kind of could be, though, just based on how early technology was.
Yeah, I mean, that was basically... I think that was basically the Frampton Comes Alive guitar effect being used to sound like angry robots. I'm pretty sure that was speech synthesis as opposed to actual sampling, whereas the Stratovox actually sounded like it was sampled as opposed to synthesized, which is why it's so hard to make out, because it's like it's probably sampled at some insanely low rate, whereas the synthesis is, you know, like sound being generated.
Yeah, like Stratovox sounded like a man coughing into a walkie-talkie. In Berserk, you actually have, like, you know, at least defined speech. And there's another game that is actually along the lines of Berserk, where it is sort of like it's sort of like an approximation of speech, and it's Q-Bert. And in 1982, the creators of Q-Bert couldn't figure out how to actually make him say words that would make sense, so they instead decided just, like, the gimmick of the game. Basically, the gimmick of Q-Bert was he was a talking character. He didn't just talk, he swore.
Yes, yes.
And the swears, even though you couldn't make them out, they were entertaining, so let's play a few of those. Here's Q-Bert's first swear. That's a... Probably in some other language, it's probably the worst thing you could ever say. Like, your mother sleeps with a pig or something. Here's another one. I'll play that again. So, yeah, I mean, these were examples of how arcades used speech as a gimmick in order to, you know, draw people in. Like, in the case of Q-Bert, that was the point of the game. I mean, I'm not a fan of Q-Bert the game. I don't know about you guys. It's kind of, I don't... Maybe just me, but...
it's all right.
I feel like most of the people who played it for that gimmick, because that's how it sold itself. Like, in the marquee art, Q-Bert is swearing. There's also the feature... Oh, go ahead, Jeremy.
I think it was really more for the character than necessarily his pretend speech. You know, Q-Bert was a kind of one of those mascot characters along the lines of Pac-Man or Donkey Kong that was presented... Didn't he have a Saturday Supercade?
I think he did. He had, like, a Letterman jacket or something.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely kind of an attempt to create that sort of unique, fun character, and, like, to me, that was kind of the appeal. That and just the game was interesting and weird.
Yeah, I mean, that whole isometric perspective gave it the appearance of 3D that other games didn't have at the time. Mm-hmm. So if you guys want to go forward ahead of this, and please stop me if I'm going too fast, I do want your commentary on all this stuff. A big landmark game for voice acting and for speech in games is Punch-Out, 1984, for the arcade.
Wait. So you totally skipped over Sinistar?
I did. I had to pick and choose. I thought Berserk was a good enough example of that. But
Sinistar, I think, is probably more famous, just, you know, the Beware I Live.
That's like, right, that yeah.
That's kind of the original arcade chiller.
That is one of the games that would, you know, taunt you from the dark corners of the arcade.
Right.
But Punch-Out is sort of like the first monumental game that I could find, and I just played this recently, and it did impress me, especially for the time. You basically have play-by-play commentary, even though it is incredibly repetitive and, you know, not the most smooth transitions between different expressions. But I feel that even though the NES Mike Tyson's Punch-Out is sort of like the most well-known of the Punch-Outs, for some reason, people remember the arcade's voice samples. Like, I hear those referenced everywhere, and I feel like the arcade game is sort of, like, not forgotten, but it's sort of, like, was way overshadowed by the NES. So let's listen to a example of a Punch-Out fight, and I'll show you guys how, basically, in 1984, think of how primitive technology was. They were able to sort of approximate what a boxing announcer would be saying during a fight. Although, no boxing announcer is this.
I can still think of those audio clips in my head, even though I haven't played the arcade game in decades.
The
like, it's really, really memorable.
The phrase body blow comes to you.
Body blow, body blow, right.
So let's listen to a little clip of the Punch-Out commentary.
Ladies and gentlemen, Glass Joe.
Okay, that's enough of that. But, I mean, you can see where they're coming from. I mean, any boxing announcer would get fired if he just described every punch he saw. He hit him again, hit him in the face, hit him in the stomach, now the face. And yeah, I mean, but still, it was a cool gimmick that it didn't really... I don't think that was the gimmick of the game because there was a really good game behind it, but it was sort of Nintendo experimenting with, like, what can we do with voice in a way that's more than just yelling at the player or, like, making fake swear words.
Yeah.
I don't know. How do you guys feel about the voice acting? If you want to call it that, I mean, these are the primitive ages we're talking about. But the Punch Out, and like, how did it affect you? Did it sort of stick out to you as a game that was impressive? I mean, I think I was drawn to it a lot because of that, because no other game was sort of talking about what you were doing as you were doing it as much as Punch Out was.
I never saw Punch Out Arcade in person for years.
Okay. Chris, did you encounter it in the wild?
I didn't either, but listening to it just now, that is really impressive for the time.
Yeah, definitely.
The quality of the sound.
And, like, the sound clip goes on for a minute, but there's more, like our new, our you know, reigning champion, I don't think they even say Little Mac, but they say you or something like that. But there's like, a lot of sentences built into the game, and I'm sure it's nothing more than, like, 50 different words, but still, like, when put together like that, I still had fun with it. I just played it again at Portland Retro Gaming Expo, and I was like, this is pretty cool. I can't believe that they were doing this in 1984.
Yeah,
it seemed really sophisticated at the time, not just for the voice acting, but there was this certain crispness to the graphics. I think, you know, it helped that your character was kind of this grid, so you could see through your character to the other guys you were fighting. And those things combined, the sound samples and the double screens and the like, just the visual presentation, made the game seem really, really advanced. And I remember being really impressed with it. And even though I'm not interested in boxing and never have been, like, that was a game that I always gravitated toward just because it looked so cool. And I think that was produced by Genyo Takeda, who has always kind of been like the guy, or at least, you know, back in the past, was the Nintendo guy who sort of looked toward the West. I mean, he was the producer on Star Tropics and some of the other games that were kind of kind of America-oriented, you know, designed for the American market, or designed to kind of capture the popularity of American concepts and sports. And this is definitely one of those where, you know, Nintendo, being a very traditional Japanese company, had always worked in a very Japanese style until Punch-Out. But that game, like, is very much sort of, you know, Saturday Night Boxing, very much an American kind of vibe to it. And so I think it's kind of unique in the Nintendo pantheon just for that purpose, or for that reason as well.
Yeah, I don't think we were seeing a lot of boxing games coming out of Japan at all at the time. This might even be the first, as far as I know. You know, I remember, like, you know, Atari 2600 had boxing, and, like, there were a lot of boxing computer games, but this might have been the first Japanese boxing game.
No.
For not even for 1984, there was some before that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, wow. There goes my gross generalization, but let's move on.
It was a good theory, but you know, in jumping to 1984, you skipped probably the first truly voice-acted video game, Bob.
Which one is that?
That would be Dragon's Lair in 1983.
See, I wasn't sure if I should count that, because it's just like...
Why not? I mean, it uses a laser disc, sure, but, I mean, there is, like, voice acting. That is a big part of the appeal, the animation, and also the announcer who's like, Dragon's Lair! I mean, there's not a lot of dialogue in the game itself, but... But, I mean, that's voice acting. That's,
I will give you that.
Right there.
I guess, like I said, this is just me picking and choosing important moments. But for that, I mean, I can see your point. But for me, it was just like, that's just like them showing you a laser disc. So I was thinking more about, like, how the technology grew. And I guess that is a piece of technology that was part of that machine, though. So
yeah, I mean, the games we're going to talk about from, you know, the Sega CD era and the PlayStation era, the Dreamcast, I mean, those games use the same technology as Dragon's Lair in a lot of senses. It's streaming media, so I can't see why you would count those games, those later games, but not Dragon's Lair, because that was a huge monumental step in video game technology. Even if the game itself wasn't that great, the impact it had and sort of the future that it foretold was very meaningful.
That's true. I mean, like, it did have professional voice actors, you know, along with the professional animation too. But I feel like it took a while for games to catch up to that point again because of certain things that happened.
Let's ask Chris.
I mean, there were Laserdisc games all, you know, throughout history after that, until optical discs sort of took over the world. So you didn't necessarily see it as much in home games, but certainly in the arcade, you had all kinds of things from, Space Ace to Cliffhanger to God knows what else. Time Traveler.
Time Gal.
So, Chris, Dragon's Lair? Dragon's Lair, yes or no?
Yeah, you'd be the tiebreaker.
I say yes.
No, okay, that's fine.
I would draw the line at the FMV games, because those, like, I think, you know, those are just screen acting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though they're you're hearing human voices, it's, I think that's a fair place to, you know, separate the two.
No, I agree with you. I mean, like... I like there is actual voice acting happening in Dragon Slayer, but there's no even acting to speak of in Night Trap. So
yeah,
we'd have to find real actors first. But yeah. Let's move on. I wanted to show you guys an example of speech being used for evil. So we have another sports game here, and I just discovered this the other day. So apparently, this is from Konami's Double Dribble game, and this is the arcade version. Apparently, they would play a god-awful approximation of the... I'm using the phrase approximation a lot, but this is the best use of it, I think. Their approximation of the Star-Spangled Banner. I don't know if I'm going to play this whole thing, but I feel like I should play the whole thing, because you really need to experience the magic, and Ray's nodding his head, of this take of the Star-Spangled Banner. So please forgive me if this is too much to handle, but it is probably the most miserable song I've ever had the displeasure of hearing, and I'll play that for you in one second.
Everybody rise and take off your hats.
Yes. This makes me think about how great America is. Let's get ready. Now, see, wasn't that worth it? Oh my god. Who's applauding for that? What was that? I'm sorry.
How did they manage to record Roseanne Barr's performance of the Star Spangled Banner?
I'd say that was more like Stephen Hawking than Roseanne Barr.
I was just thinking, never mind.
Yeah, I understand. I got the joke.
Was that on the Nintendo cartridge?
This was the arcade game. Yeah. I can't imagine what they have to do for a Nintendo cartridge to make that horrible wailing.
It would be a two-cartridge game.
I did not remember that from Double Dribble.
Yeah. I mean, I just dug that up because I was looking for examples of, like, how did they use technology to make things stupider? And that always happens, and this is a good example of that. It's like, no one wanted this. No one needed this.
I want to know what came first there, the chiptune or the singing?
Oh, my God.
Who was basing it on what?
Yeah, that's true, because whoever was singing the song, and it feels like it is just like a recording of a guy singing poorly.
Yeah.
He was way off. He was way off. Especially on that Rocket's Red Glare part. Shame on you, sir.
I like how the tempo of both tracks kind of changed up, and they were never quite in sync, even with each other. It was really amazing.
So that guy probably was murdered for treason, I guess, after the recording of that song.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
I mean, everybody makes jokes about how they just got the guy in accounting. That really does sound like someone who is just like, I'm the president of Konami. We're like five people.
So. Like, I've seen you at karaoke. You do a mean, I don't know.
Yeah. They're asking for this in Japan. Might as well do it.
Yeah. So I did want to move on a little bit. Like I said, we have to kind of accelerate how fast we're going through the technology here. But I feel like once we're away from the arcade now, and once games moved to the consoles, they experience a sort of phenomenon that sort of it still happens a lot with Japanese games, and that is the whole we're going to say the name of our game at the title screen.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels it still sort of feels like a magic trick they're doing. Just like we have a voice in our game, even though it's only one voice. So here's one that you guys may be familiar with. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Let's hear that again.
Blades of Steel.
Right. And that is still a common feature in video games, even up till today. At least I feel like Japanese developers have not let go of that.
Yeah.
And one of the more famous examples of that, obviously, is this game.
Resident Evil. Resident Evil 2. Resident Evil Resident Evil Survivor.
Okay, that's enough of that. But you understand what I'm saying, right? Like, I feel like that is something that is now antiquated, but it just became like a trend, and the purpose of it was forgotten.
In RE's case, for sure, yeah. It just became part of the... Everybody expects this.
Yeah,
for
I mean,
some reason.
I'm playing Rune Factory 4, and when you turn on the game, it goes, Rune Factory 4!
Yeah.
You're like, I feel like Japanese developers have not let go of that.
That happens a lot more on the 3DS system menu when you have that game logo pop up.
That's true, yeah.
Sometimes they'll speak that.
So, Chris, you have a ton of notes written down. I'd like you to jump in. I feel like we need to take advantage of your topic choice a lot more here.
Yeah, well, I don't know if all of these will actually end up being separate from what you've got. I mean, I was trying to think of examples of voice sampling from games before CD-ROM. There was... So, in Street Fighter, all of the announcements of, like, you know, China.
Yeah, I love that guy's voice.
And,
Japan!
When I asked friends for suggestions about, like, things that they remembered as, like, you know, early voice acting that was stuck out in their memories, the intro to Super Metroid.
Oh, yeah!
The last Metroid is in captivity.
I think that was actually read by Dan Ausen.
That's
one of the localization
people? Yeah.
Even though it sounds like a woman's voice, and he sounds nothing like that. It's just so badly sampled.
I don't know what they did. It sounds like they pitched him up or something. But go ahead,
yeah.
Chris.
So one other thing. And so the first idea that I had for a topic for this show was old Macintosh games, and I realized that would have very little appeal outside of me.
Well, it would be you and Jeremy talking to each other.
So the black and white Macintosh game Dark Castle made really good use of voice samples. Not using words, but using basically like vocal effects to give character to the enemies and to the protagonist. He would walk into a wall, and because it was a really punishing platformer, walking into a wall would stun you for a few seconds and go, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Whoa, okay. Jeremy, do you have any familiarity with this game?
No, I've never played Dark Castle. My Mac experiences came a little later. I could tell you about Scarab of Ra, but that didn't have any voice acting.
Can you tell us, Chris, what year this was?
Oh, jeez. I want to say, like, 87
okay.
or something like that.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. Is there anything up until, like, I'm sort of going to be moving into the early 90s soon, so is there anything you want to cover before we move on to that?
No, the next thing that I was thinking of was a LucasArts adventure.
Okay, yeah, we're going to get into that in a second, but before I move on, I did want to include one amazing entry, and this is sort of like the better version of the better take on using, you know, sampled voices along with music, and you guys probably all know this. This is from 1990. That's pretty awesome, isn't it? I feel it's like one of those 80s Casios where you put the sample in and you're just playing. It's like, I have Skate or and Die, and I can just sort of like make a song out of that, like the dogs barking.
Every time the sample cut into itself, it felt like someone was punching me in the ears. It was really weird. Very, very aggro, man.
It's totally lo-fi punk, guys. Now moving on to the multimedia age, the new age of multimedia.
Ah, yes.
Basically, the advent of CD-ROMs means that a lot of disk space wasn't being occupied by game data, because even though we had the CDs, the games were still relatively, I don't know, around the same size, like especially for things like Sega CD games. And this made it much easier to store pre-recorded voices in a more substantial form than the low-quality samples we heard earlier. So you could have CD-quality voices, or at least, you know, much, much better than our Double Dribble, you know,
yep.
Star-Spangled Banner. So,
and that was one of the things that they hyped up. It's like, oh my god, this is so great, right? You'll never need cartridges again.
Yeah. Thank God. So, voice acting was considered enough of a gimmick in such a niche medium that quality didn't really factor in until much later. Like, recording quality, fine, but actual acting quality, not so much. But this is not, like, a hard and fast rule. It kind of varied across the board depending on what sort of game you were looking at, and we're going to talk about a bunch of different examples. So, I did want to mention that, like, anime sort of followed the same path, oddly enough. Like, it was once considered, I mean, still is, but it was considered fringe entertainment, so the standards were much lower because the budgets were much lower. So it's just like, Jeremy, you're familiar with this, ADV Films, who did Ava, all of their talent was from Texas, so everyone sort of had like a Texas twang that didn't make a lot of sense for Japan.
That was much more with the secondary characters. Their main characters really didn't sound too Texan. But you would definitely notice it when in like some of the side characters, the minor characters of Evangelion, where it'd be like Japanese dudes on a golf course like, oh, I don't know about that. We can't commission that action.
An episode of King of the Hill was starting in the middle of it.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, yeah, there are some exceptions, though.
We can defeat the angels with propane.
Oh, did someone make that fan art already?
Dang it, Shinji!
Yeah, I knew you were going to.
All right. Oh, man, someone make that fan art. Come on, we're going to give you a prize.
The boy just ain't right.
Awesome. We're going to keep doing this the whole podcast.
Oh, no.
We'll give you a prize if you create that fan art. I guarantee it. So let's move on. But listen, there are some early exceptions to this bad voice acting rule that I brought up. So I have Ease Book 1 and 2 for the TG-16 CD. It stands out for its quality, especially for the time, for a console game and a console game from Japan.
Right.
And it sounds like a Saturday morning cartoon because it uses a lot of Saturday morning cartoon voice actors like Michael Bell, who is all over 80s and 90s cartoons. If you don't know who he is, look him up because you probably heard him talk to you a billion times.
Mm.
So let's listen to the intro to Ease Book 1 and 2, and we'll see, like, this is, I think, 1990. Is that true, Ray? Like, 90
yes.
or 91? Yeah.
Yeah.
But even so, like, this really stands out for its quality, mm-hmm. even though it might sound a little silly now. So let's listen to the beginning of this.
Ease, the ideal utopia. Once a country so peaceful and prosperous. A country where children were as free as the wind. A country where harmony blew through the hearts of all men. Ease, a kingdom ruled by the wisdom and charity of its six powerful priests.
So yeah, I mean, that was just an announcer talking, but already you can hear, like, this is a man who has taken voice acting lessons. He sounds like, I mean, he could have just been, like, radio talent or whatever, but still, there was an attempt to get someone who knew how to act in a game.
Yeah.
Can you guys
contrast that to the intro to Mega Man Legends, which came like 7 or 8 years later?
God.
In a world covered by endless water. Sounds like library storybook time, yeah.
And then contrast that with other TurboGrafx CD games on there, too.
Like Last Alert, is that the one I'm thinking
of?
Last
Alert, I was hoping you'd mention that.
Stingy. I didn't get any of those voice samples, I'm sorry.
Shouldn't be too stingy.
Yeah.
Yes, please look that up if you haven't. Last Alert is a treasury.
Audio Atrocities. That was Zach Meston's website, and apparently it's still around.
Oh, wow, I was going to ask if it is still around.
Has all that stuff chronicled and archived.
So I'm sure Chris is going to jump onto this next topic. We're going to move on to adventure games. So adventure games really grabbed onto voice acting because they were sort of a boutique luxury product for your expensive computer that you spent thousands of dollars on. So God damn it, you're going to have voice acting, you're going to have music, you're going to have everything that's coming to you as a person with a PC deserves. So unfortunately, it didn't always start well. I feel like Sierra and had sort of like, they got off on the wrong foot with voice acting. They were still in that sort of, I feel like Sierra, they were such an insular company that they wanted to do everything themselves, regardless of it was. So we're going to hear something. This is not their first game with voice acting. This is their second game with voice acting, but it's from King's Quest V. And it sounds like, I'll play this for you, but it obviously is coming from, like, rank amateurs who could not be, like, less interested in the material or... let's just listen to this.
Ooh, I can tell you what happened.
What?
Mm-hmm. what happened to your castle? I saw it all. Yes, I did.
You did? Well, then, what happened?
Oh, it was the powerful and evil wizard Mordak who did it. Oh, I just happened to be visiting with an old friend when I saw him materialize out of thin air. Thank goodness he didn't notice me.
Well, don't stop now. Go on.
No, don't. Please, stop. I don't want to hear any more of this.
Community children's
Your donation
theater.
Keeps PBS on the air.
I feel like that those voices should be coming from poorly made puppets, if anything.
Oh, yeah. No,
but yeah, and in that case...
Yes, that is a Punch and Judy punch.
Exactly. In that case, it was like obviously people who had no experience with voice acting were putting together a game with voice acting, and there was no, like, would it be annoying if a character said who before every one of his sentences? Of course not.
It's an owl.
Yeah, like, what else would an owl do? But yeah, so yeah, that's one of the examples of voice acting gone wrong, and things would get a lot better, So I'll bring this up, and Chris, can you maybe talk a little bit more about it? So the advent of CD-ROMs created the sort of now antiquated, super antiquated and adorable phenomenon of talkie versions of games. Just think about that, people. Just
yes.
Think about how it's like, I can get the regular floppy version or the CD-ROM talkie version with voices and all kinds of stuff. And usually the games would be essentially the same, maybe a few added animations they couldn't squeeze into the discs. Mm. But essentially they were the same. And LucasArts really grabbed onto this, and they sort of took their casting a little more seriously. And I think it's because they had... They were related to the entertainment industry. They knew actors. They were in that business. They had connections where maybe Sierra did not. So Lumen, Indiana Jones, and The Fate of Atlantis marked their first attempts to put voice acting into the game, and it turned out pretty good, even if, you know, it's a Harrison Ford imposter. Even if these voices were impersonated, there's still a lot of care put into them.
Still not much of an imposter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you eventually accept him as Indiana Jones, but, I mean, it's a little jarring at first. Let's listen to a clip from The Fate of Atlantis, and we'll talk a little bit more about LucasArts Adventure Games, because I feel like... more than anything else, they sort of were way ahead of things in terms of, having quality voice acting in their games. So here's Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, just like a little snippet of the intro.
I'm back. Indy?
You don't look at all well, Dr. Jones.
Exploring our collections can be dangerous, Mr. What was your name again?
Smith. Tell me, did you find a lock to match my key?
You bet I did. Take a look.
What are you waiting for? Let's open it.
Why not? It's an obvious fake.
You may think so, Doctor, but I believe we are opening a new chapter in history.
So yes, that was Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, and like the actual sampling quality is pretty hissy and low, but still there's an attempt to replicate what, you know, makes Indiana Jones Indiana Jones.
The pauses aren't still not that perfect, but compared to the King's Quest clip, it's like, oh my god.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris. Please talk about LucasArts games, and Jeremy too. I mean, I want to know what you guys think about the voice acting in these games.
Yeah. Well, so I think right after Fate of Atlantis, Sam and Max Hit the Road came out, and that... I think set the bar even higher. They got to do the voice of Sam, the guy who had already taken over the role of Goofy
right.
for Disney. And for Max, the actor's name was Nick Jameson, and he went on to be in many more LucasArts games down the road.
He did. He played Dr. Fred before he played right. Max. And if you watch the TV show The Critic, he does about half of the impressions that Maurice LaMarche didn't do on that old TV show, yes.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. And he also ended up in Psychonauts as Oleander.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Actually, let's play a clip from Sam and Max. I do have a clip from the intro of the game. And you can see this is just a few years from A Fate of Atlantis, but it's already a lot snappier. And I feel like there's a huge amount of confidence in the voice acting here because they're asking these actors to deliver absurd dialogue in a deadpan, like, matter-of-fact manner. That's what I love about these games. So right. Here's from 1994, Sam and Max Hit the Road.
Well, that was a pleasantly understated credit sequence. I enjoyed the cheesy retro ambiance. What the hell are you talking about, Max?
Sam, either termites are burrowing through my skull, or one of us is ticking.
Oops. Oh, yeah. Max, where should I put this so it doesn't hurt anyone we know or care about?
Out the window, Sam. There's nothing but strangers out there.
So, I mean, even at the time, they were sort of relying on impressions to sell the characters in a way that, you know, was immediate. Like, Sam is sort of a Humphrey Bogart-type character, and Max is kind of like a Joe Pesci-type wise guy. But still, the voice acting quality is there, and these actors are confident, and they're veteran voice actors, so they know what they're doing. Jeremy, do you have anything to add about LucasArts? Because I'm sure Chris has a little bit more, too.
Well, for starters, I think it's really fantastic that even though Tom Selleck didn't get the role of Indiana Jones for the movies, they did manage to cast him as the voice actor for LucasArts. Yeah, I mean, I played a few of the LucasArts games back in the day on CD-ROM, and I always enjoyed the voice acting they used. And, you know, not even for the adventure games, but even, like, their Star Wars games. Let's not count Rebel Assault, but something like Dark Forces. I don't know, like, the pauses you mentioned, Ray, those don't really bother me too much. It's just kind of part of that game style, and it's not a problem with the acting itself. It's more in, like, the tech and the delivery of it. It's just kind of how those games were presented, and so, like, that's something that never really bothered me. I always appreciated the fact that it felt like, you know, LucasArts games didn't just look like cartoons, but they sounded like it, too, like good quality cartoons. I mean, Max sounds like someone doing a pretty darn good Bugs Bunny pastiche. And, yeah, I really, really appreciate that. It's, you know, good to hear that sort of quality applied to a video game.
And that thing about the pauses you mentioned and Ray mentioned, too, and I think that's because the games were still built around, the dialogue was still built around how long it would take for you to read it. So the dialogue, mm-hmm. the next line wouldn't move on until it would assume that the person would have been able to read the speech because it was all timed to that. And I know you can speed the speech up.
Yeah,
but it was basically set up, I mean, like, the main version of the game was, like, you're going to be reading this, and sort of the deluxe version is you're going to be hearing this, too.
And they definitely made that better once the default version of the game was just, you know, on CD-ROM and just talking.
Yeah, and I think that was, like, Full Throttle was the first first CD-ROM-only game. That was 95 or 95, I think.
I was thinking, like, The Dig, but yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, the thing about those, like, even the non-talkie versions, they would often have the intro voiced just to let you know, like, what you'd be getting, you know, if you had a CD-ROM. So, like, I think Day of the Tentacle and Sam & Max, they would just have the intro voiced, but no other voices in the game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just to be like, hey, if you had a CD-ROM drive, guys, you'd hear these voices the whole time, so... Mm-hmm. Hit up your local Babbage's?
Yeah. Sort of like Satan standing over the city and showing all of this to Christ and saying, this could be yours if only you committed the sin of spending $3,000 on a CD-ROM drive.
It's also like that pirate who, with the loom button.
Oh, that's right, yeah. That makes sense. So, Chris, anything else? I'm going to move on from LucasArts, but I'm sure you have more to say about these games.
Well, I think that especially because LucasArts adventure games tended to be more comedic, it was really important that the voice acting be good, because you can have a very funny game with no voice acting. You can't have one with bad voice acting.
That's true.
Unless, well, not intentionally funny.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Yeah, like most of the European-made adventure games, which are then dubbed in English, and they try to be clever or whatever, and just falls completely friggin' flat.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, like, the Pendulo games.
Is that, like, Yesterday? Is that one of those...
They make Runaway.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
And the next big thing, and those are just awful.
Yeah. So let's.
And how about those Zelda CDI games?
Oh God, I see. I didn't include those because I feel like that topic is done to death. But I mean, those are classic dialogue deliveries that are burned into my head, even though I didn't grow up with them.
Yeah.
And boy.
Yeah, and those are the big ones that, you know, became internet memes later.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It's like they were built knowing what a meme was. Yeah. Just like 20 years from now, boys, we're gonna pay off. So I did want to, before, like, we're going to sort of get out of the CD-ROM territory, but I did want to hit upon a few other things, and I know I'm missing things, but like I said, this is sort of like a sampling of the history of voice acting, because this is a huge, huge undertaking.
Sure.
And I'm only one man! So I did want to play another clip about what I'm going to be talking about next, and that's celebrities in voice acting and for video games. So in the 90s... I guess, like, certain companies would get these ubiquitous kind of C-list celebrities, and that includes, I'm sorry, Mark Hamill. He was passed around a lot, even though he's a fantastic voice actor. And one of these people was also Tim Curry, I don't know who made this decision. Let's have a Cajun detective. Who's the best person to play a Cajun detective? A British guy.
Well.
And that would be Gabriel Knight. I'm going to play a clip from that in 1 second. So you're going to hear Tim Curry's approximation of a Cajun accent, and it is this reason why I couldn't play through the game. It is that bad.
Can't wait.
You're going to hear him going back and forth with his assistant. So this is a clip from Gabriel Knight. I forget the subtitle of this game, but it's the first game.
Mm-hmm. I told you, it's that voodoo book you're researching. That stuff can seriously screw up your karma.
I'm sure that's it. Maybe I should write a horror novel on passive resistance instead.
So don't sleep. It's your body. Anyway, your handheld tape recorder came today.
Really? Great.
I can't wait to see what human rights you violate with this one.
I can't wait to violate them.
surfer. Oh,
God. He sort of morphed into a surfer. Really? Great.
Right, like Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so not a good choice. I mean, it was a celebrity, but he wasn't really used in the right way, I think.
Yeah, he's done lots of voice acting.
Like, yeah.
He was going to be the Joker before Mark Hamill got the role.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I kind of feel like Tim Curry is the Snoop Dogg of acting. Like, if you have money, he'll show up and he'll do whatever you want him to do. Even though Snoop Dogg is also an actor. I'm sorry, Snoop Lion, his new name.
He made a great clown living in the sewer, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's his most iconic role.
No, I think. Oh my god, I totally blanked on the name. The Midnight Movie that everyone goes to.
Oh, Rocky Horror.
Oh god.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's it.
Yes, definitely.
I think that's probably his most iconic role, but it was one of the first experiences I ever had with Tim Curry, so that's kind of how he's baked into my brain.
So I do have a few other examples of celebrities in voice acting, and I guess this is kind of a celebrity, but this is Harlan Ellison with his game I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, recently re-released on Steam, so try that if you are interested. It's pretty cheap.
Steam
but
and GOG. Yeah.
And GOG too, yeah. So he played the computer named Am. I think it's just called Am. And it is this computer who basically keeps these seven people alive just to torture them for an eternity. And the beliefs of Am aren't too far away from the beliefs of Harlan Ellison, who is a notorious, what would you guys call him?
Crank?
Jerk? Crank, there we go. This is completely, completely divorced from politics. He's just a huge jerk.
Yeah.
So let me play the little clip from I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. And I feel this is a great delivery, even though he's not an actor. He is so intimate with the material because he created it.
Right.
I feel like he does a great job with this role. So here we go.
Hate. Let me tell you how much I've come to hate you since I began to live. There are 387.44 million miles of printed circuits in wafer-thin layers that fill my complex. If the word hate was engraved on each nanoangstrom of those hundreds of millions of miles, it would not equal 1/1 billionth of the hate I feel for humans at this micro-instant. For you, hate! Hate!
Those are actually his wedding vows. He just re-recorded them.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's Harlan Ellison. And again, like, you can go either good or bad with choosing who you want to do your voice acting. With Tim Curry, it was like maybe, you know, that accent was a little out of his reach. With Harlan Ellison, he is already crusty and evil, so he sounds like an evil supercomputer.
Yeah.
It's no bad actors, only bad casting.
That's true. I mean, I feel like Tim Curry would have been great as like a British detective, maybe. But we have one more, and Jeremy, I know you'll be into this. Like, the last time all of the surviving Star Trek members were assembled in one place for one project was the 25th anniversary CD-ROM game. And this is amazing because I feel like after a while, like, the guy who played Scotty was sort of like, I don't want to do this anymore. And then now he's dead. But there are always holdouts after a certain point in time. But at this point in time, and I believe it was like 1991, everyone was gathered together to record all of their lines. And it sounds pretty good. So here's a clip from that. And these are all of your familiar Star Trek buddies back in their original young human forms. So here we go.
We're off course, Captain.
Instruments indicate that we have crossed the Klingon neutral zone. Klingon ship is arming its weapon systems and raising shields.
Damage control standing by, sir.
Message from the Klingon commander, sir.
On screen, Lieutenant.
Enterprise, you are in violation of Klingon space. Your ship is forfeit. Prepare to die.
So I'm not sure how that happened. I mean, maybe Interplay had a lot of money, but that's pretty amazing. Yeah. What do you guys think about the Star Trek 25th anniversary CD-ROM?
Yeah, it's a little off-putting to me because it's the voices they had as older people, but they're, you know, it's being cast back in the period of the original TV series. So it just all sounds off, especially he's not on there, but Bones sounds like he is on the ragged edge of death. Which I guess, yeah, he didn't have much longer in his life at that point, so that's probably why. But, you know, he was like 90 years old, and he's like, oh, Captain Greg, it's really, really kind of jarring and a little bit dissonant if you follow Trek at all.
Like, yeah.
Didn't they get Sean Connery back for the From Russia with Love game? And it's kind of the same situation. And that happens a lot, too, even now, still, where they get these older actors back and just, yeah.
I think Marlon Brando, his last role was for a Godfather game. They never used the audio because he was like so far gone that, you know, it just seemed like cruel.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience to what Jeremy had in that, in the Back to the Future games, which I liked. Christopher Lloyd was now as old as his character was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And he sounds like just like ragged, like, Marty, I'm dying. Like, you know, like super.
I don't think it was that bad, but yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you're coming from.
Chris, did you have something to add? I'm sorry. We were.
Let's see. So on the Star Trek,
yeah, anything they, like or any sort of any other celebrity voice acting.
So one thing that I wrote down, it's much later, but in 1998, Bruce Willis lent his voice and his likeness to Apocalypse.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
That's right.
And that is a terrible game.
It's weird because this is what I heard, and I'm pretty sure it's true, that he was intended to be the sidekick.
Right.
But they made him the main character. So throughout the game, he's sort of like talking to someone who isn't there, presumably the player. So it's a bunch of like one-liners.
Yeah, he's just spouting off like lock and load over and over
again. Yeah. Go ahead. For this next section, I want to talk about Japan and voice acting. And like I said, I'm picking and choosing from the history of voice acting. I'm just sort of kind of collecting all the parts that seem to be the most important or most interesting.
Now, were you fair?
I think I was fair. to be fair, I think I chose a lot of clips that are funny. Maybe not for the right reasons, but as far as Japan goes, I think they have a much prouder history of valuing voice acting because long after we forgot about like radio plays and things like that, they're still doing those sort of productions where it's like voices only. And
And they love the actors too.
Definitely.
Nerds love voice actors.
Mm-hmm. You know, for as many VA talents that are just like washed up idols, there's a lot that have been doing it for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they receive like rigorous training as far as voice acting goes. I feel like there's a real culture of that values the importance of voice acting, at least within entertainment. So let's talk about a few of the notable, mistakes that were made. So, because I want to point out that, This sort of like valuing voice acting did not obviously carry over to the localizations of these games. And for many cases like Resident Evil, these voices were recorded in English, presumably in Japan, by voice directors that maybe didn't speak the language. I know that was the case with Shenmue, or at least someone that didn't speak the language actually had control over the direction, which is a bad, bad idea. That shouldn't even need to be said.
Right.
So yeah, like Resident Evil, I never really bought into the idea that it was supposed to be bad. Like I always understood that it was supposed to be, cheesy and kind of goofy, but not incompetent. And that's sort of the impression I got from the voice acting. So I mean, we've all heard these lines before. I just pulled one of them as an example. And I mean, it's as bad as it is. I feel like there's a great amount of value that these lines exist and are so funny and memorable. So here's one of them that I'm sure you guys know.
Oh, Barry.
That was too close. You were almost a Jill sandwich.
You're right.
So, I'm picking on this. It's an unfair example to like hold this up as like Japanese voice acting or voice acting in a Japanese game. But this is a good example of how it went wrong, where characters don't know the context of what they're saying. It feels like they're not even talking to each other.
Right.
It feels like people were just thrown into a booth, given like a list of lines to read, not even given an idea what scene they were in. And that's why, they sound like how they sound. So,
That's actually the case. That is how they recorded most of those. And, it was actually kind of a small revolution when you had, competent voice directors who would either at least give people some guidance or would actually have them record together. And that's still really pretty uncommon.
Right. And it always kind of like irritates me when, you see like a making of feature for like a Pixar movie and it's like Tom Hanks phoned in his lines literally over a DSL line. It's like, can't they get all these people together for like one day or something? It feels like you're making a movie, but, in the case of Japan, like I think all of their voice acting is typically done together as part of that sort of radio play, history that they have that they still are, continuing. And I'm going to pick on Capcom again, and this is another fantastic example of these lines were not recorded in Japan, but the threshold for quality was so low that you could even make a mistake in your game. You can even make a mistake in your acting, and they would just keep it. And playing this game, and you guys know what I'm talking about now, playing this game as a child, I was appalled that it's like, this is a professional production that I paid money for. Why did you let this flub stick around in the game? And that game is a little game called Mega Man 8, which has some almost Resident Evil style badness to it. But let's listen to our friend Dr. Light totally screw up his line twice. I love this so much.
But I've never seen this type on Earth. I don't know where this energy came from, but I cannot let it fall into Dr. Wowie's hands. You must recover all the energy immediately, Mega Man.
But where is Dr. Wily?
That's a good question. We may be able to locate another energy emission.
Cut, come on.
When we find that meteor, we'll find Dr. Wowie.
I feel like that was there's no excuse for that period. It just was like, they're not going to care, so why should we? That's sort of like, I feel like it wasn't until there were independent localization departments within companies that these things were actually, a lot more thought was put in
there. There must have been really some sort of internal burnout on Mega Man.
Yeah,
it's
like,
yeah, whatever.
Just put it out. Who cares?
It's just going to get bad review scores.
So this is jumping forward again, but I feel like this is one of my favorite examples, and this is kind of jumping out of the context of I think this is the late 90s,
actually. Wait, on Mega Man 8.
Oh, yeah. What's that?
Oh, I just wanted to say on Mega Man 8, you forgot one of the greatest failings in that they actually mispronounced the name of one of their own characters.
Bass?
They called Bass. Bass.
God.
Bass, why must we fight?
Is he called Bass anywhere else in the game or just in that one instance?
I don't think they actually... He doesn't really show up anywhere else in the game. It's just the intro. They were just like, hey, look, it's Boba Fett kind of fan service. So he just does this kind of one-off appearance, and that's pretty much it. But they didn't bother to check to see how his name should be pronounced. So they were like, oh, this guy must be a fish. Yeah, yeah. So he's Bass.
Let's see. Rock, roll, Bass. Okay, let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So I have one more unfairly bad clip to play, and it is from the game House of the Dead 2, one of my favorite games with bad voice acting. And in this case, I believe a lot of the voice acting, if you listen to it, it sounds like it was done by Japanese actors who were sort of reading their lines phonetically, or maybe were not super familiar with the language. But
I want to say right now, it's probably Western people who were just reading lines provided from the Japanese side and just read it as is.
I want you to listen to Goldman. I hear a weird accent in this that feels like a Japanese speaker, maybe reading lines phonetically, or maybe just not being very good at speaking English.
It's certainly possible.
So let's listen to Goldman, one of my favorite characters from House of the Dead, and we'll find out.
I've been waiting for you, friends.
Goldman! Do you know what you're doing?
I'm fully aware of what I'm doing. Can't you see? Man committed a sin, disturbing the life cycle of nature, the original sin that man is responsible to protect the life cycle. I have made a creature to rule over mankind. This is the final battle. Show yourself, our new ruler, the Emperor.
So who knows what's going on with that guy? Yeah, but it sounded,
I think with that guy, you're right.
Yeah, the other actors obviously were not, you know, They sounded like they were either American or not Japanese, but with that case. But they were still confident enough to trot that out as, here's our voice acting, you know, which I find very funny. And that was, I believe, 99. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have any other examples of bad Japanese voice acting? I mean, like I said, there's so much of it. Or bad voice acting in Japanese games. I had to pick and choose some of the more infamous cases. But I'm going to move on to good voice acting in a minute, but I'm not sure if you guys had anything else.
Of course, there's Symphony of the Night.
Yeah.
That's true.
But is Shenmue beyond the scope of this podcast period?
It kind of is, but I mean, it is tied into the fact that I believe Yu Suzuki does not speak English, and I think the major problem with that localization was he had complete creative control over the dub.
Yes.
And go ahead, Ray.
Here's the thing about that, is that Yu Suzuki loved the English dub so much that he made Shenmue the movie, which was just all the scenes stitched together. And they just put it in a limited run in theaters at first, but then they packed it in as a DVD with Shenmue 2 on Xbox. And it's just, he just loved it so much that he wanted to make a movie out of it. And there you go.
I believe that the voice actor for Ryo was chosen based on what he looked like.
Sure.
Like whether or not he could act. I think he was like a kickboxer or like a gymnast or something like that. Sorry, Jeremy, go ahead.
No, that's the most important thing for a voice actor. What is he going to look like on the mic?
So yes, don't trust people implicitly if they haven't proven themselves in certain categories, and that was the story of Yu Suzuki, or at least the story of his downfall. Chris, did you have anything to add as far as bad voice acting goes?
Well, like I mentioned at the beginning, the RPG list goes on for
time. Please list some examples. I'd like to know what, obviously Star Ocean 2, right?
Yeah, Star Ocean 2.
That was about 50 points. What does that mean?
Yeah. And I mentioned Grandia.
Right. Was it more a case of repetitive voice samples or just the quality of the acting?
It was just, I mean, I may be being a little bit unfair because I haven't listened to it in a long time, but I recall it being just like very like bottom of the barrel anime.
Yeah. It's like sub, like the worst label on DVD. Yeah.
And it doesn't help when the characters have to say things like, you know, you don't know what it means to be human.
Oh, yeah. Like deep philosophical conversations happening with like grade school level acting is never a fun time.
Yeah. I mean, with Grandia 2 especially, I mean, that was not published by Square Enix or anybody else who at least had a competent localization record. It was done by like Ubisoft, I believe. And so there was sort of that dark period where you had companies handling these big involved RPGs with voice acting that didn't really have enough experience in how to put those things on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's a big one.
So we're going to move on to when things got a little bit better for Japanese games, at least the English localizations of them. So a key figure in this, I believe, was Jeremy Blaustein, and he sort of spearheaded the turning around of Konami's localizations. I believe he might be responsible for Symphony of the Night. I'm not sure.
I don't remember.
Okay.
But Jeremy, no?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I know the casting director was... I don't remember seeing his name in the credits at all for that.
Okay. But
he was probably busy with Metal Gear at that point.
That's true, yeah. So one of his first major games for the company was Snatcher, mm-hmm. and there is a ton of text in that game, a ton of voice, and it's basically a visual novel, which not a lot of those were coming to America, and this might have been one of the handful that actually did make it over before, like
you
Phoenix
can split
Wright.
Some hairs. I mean, yeah. It's still basically an adventure game.
I don't know,
visual novel exactly.
That's true. I mean, it's a lot of reading. It's a lot of like going over all the data until something else unlocks. Yeah. But I don't want to split hairs. That's there's no point in that.
But I do love the acting in it.
Yes, the acting is great. I'm going to play a clip from it. So, yeah, this game sold like garbage because of its platform, obviously. But such an amount of care went into the voice acting, and I believe it was recorded in New York, so it wasn't just like, let's find people in Japan that can speak English, which...
I think it was Chicago.
Chicago?
There was a Retronauts episode where we interviewed...
That's right, yeah. I was thinking of a city with big buildings and wind.
Yeah, we did talk to Jeremy Blaustein about it.
So here is the intro for Snatcher, just a little snippet of it. And it may sound a little hokey and it may sound a little stilted, but it was still a major improvement for 1994, especially for a Japanese video game that's been localized. So here is a little bit of Snatcher.
How was work? Everything okay?
Gillian, what is it? What's wrong?
Jamie, I've become a junker.
A junker? Gillian, but why?
Jamie, you know why. It's the only way we can regain our lost memories. Snatcher is the only word that keeps coming back every time we try to remember our past. I have to face them to find out why.
Yes, but I can sense that there is something terrible hidden in our past. And if we remember it, it will destroy us.
Jamie!
Okay, that dialogue is courtesy of Hideo Kojima. But localization is all Jeremy Blaustein, and I feel like that was a major turning point, even though I didn't experience it until about a decade later when I finally got a chance to play it. If I would have played it at the time, I would have been amazed. So, anything else on Snatcher, guys? I mean, I do want to move on through a few more examples of sort of the gradual improvement of localizations in terms of voice acting.
Well, in that interview from Retronauts, it was back in like 2008 or
That's
so,
right, yeah.
Jeremy Blaustein mentioned that the cast had worked with each other before, so they had some chemistry and were recording in the same booth. So that sort of ties into what you were saying about how, like, when people can act off each other and have context for what they're saying, that it comes out a lot better in the performance.
That's definitely true, especially with Snatcher. Ray, did you have anything to add?
No, just play Snatcher.
Sweet, yes. Play Snatcher, for God's sake. It's great, and I'm sure it's hard to find, but you can find it, guys. Yeah. I trust you. So 1998, I feel, was a good big year for voice acting in video games, at least in localized Japanese games. I'm going to keep saying that because that's what we're talking about. So something that I like a lot, I'm not sure if you guys do, it's Brave Fencer Musashi. I've got a soft spot for that game.
Yeah.
It has problems, I'll admit. But its localization was done by Richard Honeywood, who is a very important figure in video game localization. And
key guy behind Dragon Quest VIII.
Exactly, and sort of like the whole Dragon Quest English atmosphere, you know, like how it, the Bible, sort of how it's written today, if any more games will ever come out here, that is. But Brave Fencer Musashi, it had a real Saturday morning boisterous quality to it and used a lot of like really veteran anime voice actors from like really, I guess, high-budget anime stuff. Not like your Texan productions, more like, you know, Canada, New York, LA, things like that. So I'll play a little clip of Brave Fencer Musashi, and it's cheesy as hell, but I feel like there's so much life in these voices and so much like characterization, where before, a lot of the times, like with the King's Quest game that we listened to, there was like no energy. This, there's nothing but energy in it, and I'll play a Brave Fencer clip right now.
Hey, stupid! Huh? Musashi? I'll get you off for wrecking my darling steam knight!
Yeah, yeah, where's the princess?
Y'all don't want to know, that's for sure. Oh, yeah, I don't have time to mess with ya.
So, super Saturday morning cartoony. The acting is good, and there's a lot of energy, and I feel like even choices like that guy's accent, I'm sure he had like an Osakan dialect or whatever in the original game, and that's always the default choice, but still, there was that much attention being put into it where you would have not have seen it before. Any other thoughts on this?
I think Brave Fencer Musashi succeeds kind of on the same level as Sam and Max, in that it was so kind of ridiculous and over the top. You know, the overall localization, all the kingdoms and the characters had names of food. There was like the all-you-can-eat kingdom. I can't remember what else, but you know, it was just totally ridiculous. So it gave the actors a lot of scenery to chew on, which is why, you know, you kind of get that like preposterous, totally goofy, just embracing it and going whole hog kind of voice acting quality, which is great. I mean, it totally fit the game itself.
Yeah, and like so many of the characters, their vocal tics are just stereotypes or, you know, stereotypical accents or something, sort of to characterize them even greater than what you would know about them. So you can already tell from that guy, he's sort of like a hick or whatever. That's what they're at least trying to sell you with that accent. But moving... Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Jeremy.
Sorry, go ahead. No.
Okay, cool. So our last example here, and it's obviously the biggest, the big daddy of all localizations, at least for the time, a major turning point was Metal Gear Solid, also by Jeremy Blaustein. It has tons of dialogue, and it could have gone really, really wrong. Obviously, some of the characters have accents that sort of define their personality in a way that would later be taken away from those characters, like, what's your save... game buddy's
Bailing.
Name. Yeah, she has a Chinese accent, but she was raised in America or something like
that.
And
then in Twin Snakes, she was given regular
American. Yeah, that's true. And was Naomi, her British accent was taken away?
Naomi had a South African accent originally,
right, yeah.
And for whatever reason, they took that out. Like, I understand them taking Mei Ling's accent out, but Naomi's accent kind of was a little bit of a loss, I think. Like, she made more sense. And then, of course, you had Nastasha, who had a very, very stereotypical Russian accent.
Loose and squeal.
Yeah.
Sniper Wolf also had kind of a stereotypical sort of, like, you know, vaguely... Yeah.
Right. She was Serbian, right?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, for as seriously as Metal Gear takes itself, it is sort of like a send-up of James Bond in a lot of ways.
Yes.
So I feel like those over-the-top accents really lended a lot to the characterizations, and I feel like there's also what I like. We heard a lot of like boisterous, cartoony voice acting before, but I feel like what Metal Gear Solid had that the other games didn't have is that the voices had a lot of like humanity to them. Like they had a lot of texture to them, and I'm gonna play a clip, and it's a little silly, but I feel like David Hayter and the guy who plays Otacon, they have like some really distinctive voices that you don't really hear a lot in voice acting, and I feel like there's like a real weathered quality they both have, even if David Hayter's sort of playing it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And he sounds a lot younger in this clip. You're going to be kind of startled if you haven't heard Solid Snake's original voice in a while. So I'm going to play this, and maybe you guys can let me know what you think of this in 15 years later.
How long are you going to stay in there?
Are you one of them?
No, I'm not. I always work alone.
Alone? Are you an otaku too?
Come on, get out.
So yeah, I chose a silly clip. But I mean, I feel like Otacon's voice was just something that really stood out to me as just this, I don't know, this type of voice I didn't really hear a lot in video games.
He has a great, believable nerd voice.
Yeah, yeah. Right, it wasn't like Steve Urkel. Like they could have went way over the top with it, but they didn't. Sorry, Chris, did you have anything to add about this?
You mentioned Jeremy Blaustein's localization, but I also think that the voice director, Chris Zimmerman, deserves a lot of credit
for how this
came out. And so she has done all of the Metal Gear Solid games, and also a year later would do Soul Reaver, which is another... It's not a localized game. It was written in English, but has a lot of very complicated dialogue that's delivered really well.
What was the person's name again?
Chris Zimmerman.
Chris Zimmerman. Also of interest is the fact that she's married to Patrick Zimmerman, who played Revolver Ocelot. Yeah.
I believe they're divorced now.
Oh, yeah. She was married. Yeah. And yeah, actually, they were divorced at the time, but they like continued to collaborate, I think.
I'm going
to
ask, I'm not sure if anyone knows the answer to this, was she behind the Cowboy Bebop dub? I feel like there was some connection there, and that was one of the first dubs people really sat up and went, this is really good. Like, this is actually sometimes better than the original.
I don't think so.
Hmm. I could be thinking of someone else.
I mean, she has done, like, a lot.
That's true, yeah.
You know, both cartoons and video games.
And like, one of the interesting things I read about this, and, like, apparently Kojima was not happy with the localization as much as he cares about his products in English, it seems, based on things I've seen lately, or things he said lately. And like, if you go to Hardcore Gaming 101, they had an interview with the Metal Gear Solid 2 localizer, and she was talking about how all of these awkward things, they could not be changed, and like Kojima was like totally adamant that there were things changed in the first game he was not happy with, and a lot of that was to make them, you know, sound more natural coming from, you know, an English speaking, you know, perspective, but I guess, you know, he doesn't see it that way, which is a shame because I thought Jeremy Blaustein did an amazing job, and Metal Gear has gotten kind of a little. I don't know. How would you describe it, Ray? I don't know if you agree with me on this. Just
it's crawled up its own ass in a lot of ways.
That's true, yeah. It's just people would say outrageous things in Metal Gear Solid 1, but I feel like they were framed in a way to make it seem a little more natural. But I feel like that has gone out the window because that is sort of what Metal Gear is known for now. So it's like, just make it as crazy as possible. Don't try to put it in the context of reality or anything like that. So, yes, guys, we're coming up to the end. Before, what's going on?
How could you go through the year 1998 and not mention one of the finest localizations, something that I alluded to earlier, but in a negative way, but that's Mega Man Legends, which starts out really rough, and after about an hour, it gets really good. It has that same Saturday morning quality that Brave Fencer Musashi does. Like, the characters, or the actors, I think, kind of warm up to their roles as the game goes on. And by the end of it, it's really, really great.
And I meant to pull a clip of that. Maybe I'll stick one in. But Tron Vaughn, in particular, I think she did a really amazing performance. And that is a very...
Teasel Bond
as well. And that game is a very Canadian voice acting-ish game. I mean, I feel like Mega Man's voice is ultra-Canadian, like super-Canadian.
Yeah.
And but that is not very distracting to me. I feel like, I don't know, Trombone. Have you guys have any experience with Mega Man Legends, the dub at all?
Yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
Like, anything stand out for you?
No, I kind of agree with Jeremy for sure. And Legends 2 is really good.
That is, yeah.
On that.
Yeah, and with Legends 2, they ditched Corey Sevier as the voice actor for Mega Man and replaced him with Sailor Jupiter's voice actress, I think. So there's kind of this big change in the character's voice, but it works. I mean, it still sounds good. Everyone else is the same, so, you know, the context works.
Yeah, in Mega Man Legends 2, is he voiced by a woman?
Yes.
Okay, I thought so. Yeah, I prefer that voice. So before we move on, I mean, we see like a steady progression of voice acting is slowly getting better, but always there are always going to be examples of how like, oops, we screwed up, or oops, we're not like following examples from the past. And this is one of my most favorite examples. We're just talking about a few years after Metal Gear Solid, and we think, yeah, you know, localization has itself figured out, but I guess we were wrong in some cases, and here's why. And that's them laughing at you for spending $50. Okay,
Bob,
please justify it.
I'm not gonna let that slide.
I refuse
to. That is supposed to be awkward.
I refuse to hear that argument. But please continue. Okay. No, please continue, Jeremy.
The whole point of that scene is that, like, he's trying to cheer her up by being completely ridiculous. And the rest of the voice acting in the game is actually really good. Like, people point to that all the time as like, oh my god, voice acting is so terrible. But no, I mean, like, that scene does exactly what it's supposed to do. If you've seen the clip in Japanese, they sound stupid in Japanese, too.
I think the thing is, that was always a dumb scene. But I remember...
Sure, it's a dumb scene, but I'm just saying, like, the voice directing there and the acting is serving the purpose of that scene. Now, whether or not that scene is good, that's a different question entirely.
I think maybe if the localization team had more input or control over what had happened there, then maybe it would have been a little bit more believable to some respect. But yeah,
yeah,
as it is now, I do agree with Jeremy, by the way, but yeah, it's just like, yeah, it's people just don't.
And they also have those weird puppet mouths, which I don't know if they're fixing.
Right. Yeah, that's okay. So that's one of the complications of, you know, especially some of the older Final Fantasies that had voice acting, which is that the lip flaps of the characters were sort of non-changeable for the English version, and they were synced up to the Japanese dialogue. So the voice directors and the dialogue writers, localizers, had to work around basically, you know, like mouth movements that were written for a different language. And Japanese tends to be a much more terse language than English. Much less needs to be said to get certain points across, especially in kind of like casual conversations that you see between a lot of those characters. So it creates a really awkward situation for the voice actors, or, you know, not just the voice actors, but also the directors. So I have some sympathy there, and that's something that has gotten better with the advent of better technology. And
that does feel like a victim of the localization, that there was not the money or the concern, where I think in Kingdom Hearts they were like, yes, we're going to do lip sync, and this is going to be the future of things. But yeah, but I also feel like with games like Final Fantasy, they often like literally translate voice acting that is not done in America, so it just sounds like ridiculous. Like all the little like utterances and moans and things that you don't normally hear in like English voice acting, but it's like a staple of Japanese voice acting.
Yeah,
I find that like literally just translating all of those or just bringing them all over makes it seem like just a strange product. For I don't sure. know.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of times the people who work on the localization make a huge difference. I mean, compare Final Fantasy XII to Final Fantasy XIII, and I would say XII has a greatly superior localization. I know some people are like, oh, that fake Shakespeare stuff is stupid, but it fits the setting, and it sounds good. The voices, the voice acting, all the actors are really well cast. Even Fran, who has that kind of weird, like, Scandinavian or Norwegian accent.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite voices in a game, like, period.
Yeah.
You've never heard anything like that.
And then you compare that to Final Fantasy XIII, which has more of kind of like the typical awkward anime localization, and you have characters like Vanille who do those orgasmic moans when they attack, and it's a little less refined. And, you know, that's because I would say you didn't have Alex Smith and some of his collaborators working on the localization as they did on 12. And, you know, no disparagement intended to the people who worked on 13, but like there is that kind of like difference in A class and S class, if you want to put it in Japanese RPG terms.
So let's move on to some final questions here. I'm out of clips, unfortunately, but we have a few questions I do want to wrap up with. And one of them we didn't really talk about. I think I mentioned this briefly in the music episode. So with the advent of voice acting, that means characters that were once mute were now, people had to figure out, like, what is this person going to sound like? And I wanted to know, like, do you guys have any examples of characters that you hate what they sound like, or characters that you were surprised that they figured out, like, sort of, oh, that's a voice that this character would have? And I know there are a few, like, historically that, like, there's a lot of controversy over Guybrush. Like, that was a character who had existed almost a decade up to that point in 1996. Maybe, sorry, like 5 years. But still, he was an iconic character. People loved him, and giving him a voice seemed like a sacrilege. Do you guys remember anything, like, sort of that sort of, like, oh, I hate this character, or I love this character? Maybe we'll start with Jeremy. Can you think of anything, Jeremy?
I mean, I actually kind of had a soft spot for the gravelly, rough Brooklyn sound they gave Mario in the early years, and I think Charles Martinetto is fine, and he's really helped define the Mario world, especially with the kind of, like, similar but different voices for characters like Luigi and Wario. But, I don't know, Mario talking like this, it's kind of hard to beat that, because it's just a little different than the family-friendly image you expect from a Nintendo game, you know what I'm saying?
Special guest, Bob Hoskins. Yeah, it was weird. Like, I'm glad you brought that up, and I think I talked about this before, but please forgive me if I have. But it felt weird that, like, the choice to make Mario, like, a Mickey Mouse-type voice, I don't know where that came from, but it didn't seem that odd to me. I just was like, this is a strange choice, but I'll roll with it, you know?
Well, they have Mickey Mouse aspirations for the character.
That's true, yeah. It's
a mascot character who is universal, plug and play. So, I mean, it makes sense in that regard, but I don't know. I liked the rougher, you know, blue collar Mario that they used in the earlier years. It's a little bit of a shame that they've lost that, but So it goes. And also, you know, I would say that's more Benny the Cab than Bob Hoskins.
That's true. So, Chris, did you have anything, any examples that you wanted to bring up? Like a voice acting, you either, like a character finally being voiced, you were like, oh, I like it, or oh, I hate this.
I don't know. I didn't have a problem with Guybrush's voice. Although, come to think of it, I may have actually played the game where he has a voice before.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe that doesn't count. But in terms of a bad one, this is something that I think Retronauts has harped on a lot, but Toad's voice.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I won't try and do it, but it's pretty bad. Weirdly,
like, strangely enough, he had that voice in the cartoons before they gave him that voice officially, but it was not as high-pitched. It was sort of like, hey, Mario, what are you doing? It was like a kind of a Brooklyn-y, you know, like, it was still like a wise guy type voice, you know. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm really sorry for doing that, guys. I didn't mean to do that. Ray, did you have any examples?
Yeah, I was trying to think of something not Mario, but I guess Mega Man really hits me in the gut. Mega Man 8, Mega Man.
You weren't expecting a small or like a lady voice to come out of Mega Man?
Well, at first, no. But, I mean, later on, I figured out, okay, yeah, the Japanese voice actors always go with that little high-pitched voice. And that's okay, that's fine, but don't try to, like, completely emulate that for the English. But then again, you have the other extreme, which is the Mega Man cartoon series voice. And that's not that great either. That's just like, it's an adult man. Like, it doesn't quite work.
A little too masculine.
Yeah.
As for me, I have to go back to Monkey Island, unfortunately, even though that's kind of the example I keep giving. And it wasn't Guybrush, it was actually the character Stan, from Stan's previously used whatever, depending on what game it would be. Mm. And he was sort of like a smooth-talking, fast-talking, like, used car salesman, obviously, that was sort of the character. But they sort of gave him, like, a game show host-type voice, and it was a little, it wasn't as slick as it needed to be. And I don't know if they ever improved upon that, but I know I wasn't the only one to sort of hate that approach to Stan. Luckily, he's kind of a secondary character, so...
They gave a voice to Pac-Man in Pac-Man World 3 before they sort of rebooted the character into that blue-eyed thing. I forget who did the voice. I want to say Billy West, but I don't think it was.
I prefer Pac-Man from Pac-Man 2, that voice.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that voice. There you go.
I kind of liked him in Pac-Land. It had that kind of, the Pac-Man cartoon that they based Pac-Land on. It had that kind of, you know, like Ralph Cramden, Fred Flintstone, sort of everyman blue collar. I guess I like my blue collar heroes. What can I say? And one other character, I guess this isn't technically a video game, but the Captain N version of Simon Belmont always baffled me. Like, how did they get to Vane Surfer from, from Middle Ages vampire killer clad in leathers and furs?
I'll tell you how: a dartboard. That's how they figured out their characters. So another question I wanted to ask you guys is something I feel like, and Jeremy brought this up earlier, which is a really excellent point, the sort of dominance of certain voice actors. I notice this a lot because I'm a big fan of animation, and it seems like people that make animation really like certain voice actors. So, like, we're going to have that voice actor in our show. It's going to be great. The only problem is that voice actor is also in every other show doing similar voices. So, especially in the 90s, you had this, like, wash of, like, nothing but, like, Frank Welker and Jim Cummings and Charlie Adler, like, doing every voice known to man. And in games, it's getting to the point where it's like, yes, Nolan North, that's funny. Now that we're all aware of the joke, I don't want Nolan North to not have, you know, jobs, but still, it's really distracting to hear the same voices over and over. How do you guys feel about that?
I mean, I love what they did with Saints Row 4, where you have, like, you have three different male voice options. It's like different pitches, different styles, three female options, and Nolan North. They also did the same thing with Keith David, where, like, the president's advisor is Keith David. It's not voiced by Keith David, it is Keith David. So they basically just said, you know what, this is like such a video game cliche, let's just brace it right up front. And I respect that.
I don't. That's like one of the things that bugs me about Saints Row. It's like stuff that's way too on the nose for me. It's just like, okay, yeah, great, funny, haha. Nolan North, I get it. But
fine,
yeah.
Bob.
Okay.
No, that's Ray.
Yeah, that was Ray.
Or Ray, sorry.
Okay.
That guy with the three-letter name.
So, Chris, did you have any, like, how do you feel about this topic, this issue about the dominance of certain voice actors? Do you find it distracting? Like, how do you feel?
I mean, I think definitely, like, with, you know, Nolan North, if you just have him do his normal voice, then, yes, it's going to start getting distracting when, like, you know, the Desmond from Assassin's Creed sounds exactly like, what's his name from Uncharted?
I think it's like every affable white guy protagonist.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. But on the other hand, in Portal 2, he does voices that you would not know it was him.
Hmm, okay. Yeah, I know he is
the,
like...
the orbs and the malfunctioning turret.
He does a great Penguin in Arkham Origins. It's like this kind of gravelly Cockney accent. I didn't realize it was Nolan North until I looked up the voice credits.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the problem is that, you know, a lot of times they're not given enough range. But once they do, it's like, yeah, then they can finally spread out and see, oh, yeah, he's pretty good. Yeah. And, I just thought, like, man, I have not played a lot of Nolan North games. I've probably played more games with Troy Baker in them. Just by virtue of, like, Atlas games, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. So, this is my final question, and it's a bit of a controversial one, or it could be. My question is, now that voice acting is sort of a given, and not some sort of amazing magic trick that we're all astounded by its very existence, is it still necessary? I mean, what do you think the best use of voice acting is in our modern age? And I'll start, and I'll go on to Jeremy after that. I feel like... the game is about a narrative, like it's an adventure game or it's a visual novel or something like that, I tend to skip voice acting just for the sake of getting that information faster. Like, you can read me the text, but I can read it a lot faster than you, and I'd rather just do that because if I know what your voice sounds like, I can sort of understand that in my brain. Because, I mean, I read a lot anyway, so that's sort of how I feel about it. Jeremy, how do you feel about voice acting? Like, what do you think its presence should be in our modern age?
I mean, I think it really depends on presentation. If you're going for a cinematic Hollywood-style, you know, movie experience with your video game, then yes, use voice acting, have full voice acting. That makes sense. If it's a game where people are primarily reading and it's more, you know, like an RPG or something, a lot of times voice acting tends to be a distraction. Maybe not so much with a Final Fantasy, but, you know, with like an Atlas kind of RPG. I don't know. To me, it doesn't really add anything. And so for something like Etrian Odyssey Retold, I just turn off the voice acting because no offense to those actors and actresses. I don't want to hear them. I'm you know, getting through the text a lot faster just by reading it. And it's a lot less distracting. But, you know, stuff that's kind of like seamless and in the background, like, you know, Mario's hoot and holler type shouts, like that stuff's fine. It gives a little personality to the game as long as it doesn't overdo it.
So, Chris, how do you think?
I more or less agree. Like, I think my tolerance for average voice acting has gone down a lot over time. And in a lot of cases, I choose to turn it off. But I would point to Portal 2 as a case of that really set a new bar for what you can do with, like, really funny dialogue delivered really well.
Right, and I think Valve does a great job of never sticking you in one place and forcing you to, like, listen to something. You're always, like, always doing something while you're listening to
Although, I did stop and just wait for Stephen Merchant to finish ad-libbing many times in that game.
Oh, I did too, yeah. But who couldn't resist that? Mm. Ray, how do you feel about this topic?
Well, yeah, it's definitely a foregone conclusion now, especially if you're playing a game that's $39.99 and up. So, I mean, yeah, not much to say about that. But I think also if you're making Pixel Platformer number 5 billion and 8 for iOS, you know, you probably don't need to make the extra expense.
That is true. So we've all tackled that controversial topic. It's time to wrap things up. So you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, SoundCloud, and Twitch.tv as Retronauts. I've been doing some streams lately, so please keep an eye on our Twitter and Facebook to find out more about when I'll be doing more streams. I recently played through Clock Tower, and that was a lot of fun. So also, I want to tell you guys one thing. Make sure you go to our blog. Maybe like 5% of our listeners actually go to our blog. And it's not like we're making money if you go there, but we put a lot of work into the blog posts we write for each episode. And you can find out like more links related to things we're talking about. You can find out what music we use in the show. You can find out everything you need to know about every episode. Just go to Retronauts.com. I want to see those numbers go higher or you guys are all grounded for a week. Yes, I'm throwing down the hammer. So, and one more thing, please keep the reviews coming on iTunes. If you haven't left us a review, please do. It helps us a lot. It helps us maintain a presence in the iTunes store, and more people will listen to us, and we can keep doing this for as long as our bodies can hold out.
Just maybe not review us based on this Skype call.
Yeah. We are working.
Is it that bad?
No, it's fine. I mean, people have high standards sometimes, but we're doing our best. I do want to thank Chris for coming in again. Thank you so much, Chris, for coming in, giving us a topic, and giving us money as well.
No problem. It's been a pleasure.
And before I wrap up, I do want to give out contact info. I am at Bob Servo on Twitter. Chris, do you want to say like who you are or where we can find you?
Let's see. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Shrugs. D-O-C-T-O-R, Shrugs.
Wait, no underscore?
No underscore.
Okay.
I can spell the word shrugs, too, if
no
you want
backslash.
Me to.
Backslash.
We're good.
yeah. That's right. That's pretty much it.
Cool. How we do Ray and Jeremy next?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I'm on Twitter, RDBAAA. I'm not really have much in the hopper as of this recording, but, you know, I'm still working on Scroll, my magazine, scroll.vg, and, yeah.
Oh, there was something, actually, sorry.
Oh, cool.
Something I wanted to plug. It's not mine, but if you're interested in the subject, you're probably going to be interested in a documentary called I Know That Voice that's being put together by John DiMaggio, the voice of Bender from Futurama, that is
and
about...
And Baka from Final Fantasy X.
We're back.
I didn't know that.
And what's his face? Marcus Fenix from Gears of War. Yeah. He's everywhere.
And Jake from Adventure Time. And,
yeah.
But anyway, it's... knocking the mic over. it is about, you know, voice actors and what they do, and you can find info about that at iknowthatvoice.com.
Cool. Well, thanks for that, Jeremy. Where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, and I write in my day job for usgamer.net and in my free time for 2dimensions.com. That's numeral 2-dimensions.com. Although, actually, I think two-dimensions.com works, too. I'm just that stupid with my money.
Buy every variation of that URL.
Yes, I will own it.
So
anyway, that's where I am.
Cool. Anyhow, guys, thanks a lot for joining us. Thanks again to Chris for sponsoring this episode, and we'll see you all again next week. Later. Mm-hmm.